Someone says kindness and appreciation, let's recognize it. Let's not dismiss what that person says and think, oh, they don't know what they're talking about. Trust the person, they mean it. So our inner renewal will help us a great deal in life to be able, it's only, not the hard stuff, you know, the water. Yeah.
Alcohol-free
water. Alcohol-free water. I think somebody around here turned it into wine about 2,000 years ago, didn't they? Anyway, it's another story. All right, come on, have some water. Perhaps I shouldn't mention that here. Just a bit dry. It's been a non-talk. Stop talking here for 12 days. So. Great, thanks. In the Buddhist tradition, some of you will be maybe a little familiar with it. And just to make a very quick point, and I just made this at the very beginning of the retreat that we had in a kibbutz not so far, about an hour away from here, that in Israel you already have three major religions. I don't need to tell you what they are. And I would think the prospect of having a fourth, I would consider it as a nightmare, given the relationship between the other three. So these teachings are not concerned with bringing a new religion into it to Israel. You've got more than enough to deal with already. What is important, and I like the words of the Buddha, he said, I teach two things, he says, I state two things. One, there is suffering in this world. Not that life is suffering. One, there is suffering in this world. Two, there is the complete resolution of it. I don't teach anything else. So he's not interested in promoting Buddhism. If he saw Buddhism today, he would weep at it, at the state of the religion. So it's just issues of suffering and its resolution which take the priority here. In the Noble Eightfold Path, which is a reminder to you and I to actually attend to and give real... Great. When I was in the Sinai, I went through 4 to 5 liters, it was midsummer, in a single day or something. And I went to the top of Mount Sinai, but you'll be relieved to know I didn't come down with any new commandments. Oh dear life. So sometimes when we look with this reminder of the Noble Eightfold Path, basically it's a reminder to each and every one of us to look to every area of our life and not to be afraid to do that. One of those eight is mindfulness, number 7, and number 8 is samadhi, which means meditative concentration, just as you and I were doing for a quarter of an hour earlier. So what is this mindfulness? Why do the Buddhists go on about it morning, noon and night? And why is it such an important feature? So we might say, just in very simple terms, what is it to be unmindful? And we all know the consequences of being unmindful. We were driving along the roads here in Israel, which are far too many, and while driving along, we suddenly find that we seem to need to have a very close relationship with the number plate of the car in front. We're not quite sure why. Then we slam on the brakes. Then we realise we weren't being very mindful. You know, we go out of the home like an electric train in the morning. We get way down the road, and then we realise that we've forgotten some important paper for work. So then we turn around, causing complete chaos, and race back home. What else do we do at home? Oh, we decide that we're rather stiff and tired. We decided to put the bath on. And then we go on, then we switch on the television, and we whatever, what start watching whatever it might be, MTV, and completely forget about the bath, and then of course the water's all over the place. I thought MTV was, for about 3 months of watching it, was meditation TV, and I couldn't, you know, I was doing my best to be open-minded about new forms of meditation. It was a little, I have to confess, a little hard, though my teenage daughter had no problem. Anyway, so sometimes we look, we say, oh, this act of unmindfulness brings me a problem. This act, simple act of unmindfulness can bring me suffering. This act of unmindfulness can bring me suffering to myself or to others. So it's useful and beneficial to be mindful. So mindfulness, as the Buddhists rightly point out, for 2,500 years, is an expression and a development of a conscious life which gives care to what we do and what we express. Not only giving support and protection to ourselves, but also and equally to other people. So mindfulness is a safeguard, and if you and I can practice it and develop it, just being more mindful in the ordinary and the everyday, it will help significantly to feel a closer connection with who we are and what we're doing. But that mindfulness is an important point, needs the second link in the Eightfold Path, which is right intention. Because, for example, if you have a burglar in your home, I mean, I'm sure it hasn't happened in Israel, but in England, it was extraordinary. I live in a house, I have to tell you this, 58 houses in my street. It's one of little, built in late 1930s, and little terraced houses, you know, instantly forgettable. And a woman came to visit, who I know, visit me, and she was rather concerned. She said, my son, she said, has just got sent down is language, but sent to prison, for 3 years. And I said, oh, why has he got sent to, you know, why did he get sent to prison? She said, well, he did go into the police station and confess. She said, he burgled 11 houses. And she said, three of them were in your street. So sometimes one can be, it wasn't one of mine, not that there's much worth taking, but anyway, it's probably why he didn't come. But anyway, we could be sitting, if you have the privilege, sitting downstairs watching television. The burglar upstairs is more mindful than all of you meditators have ever been in your entire life put together. He, it's nearly always men, takes those steps in the room, every little sensation of his foot and his hand reaching out and touching that drawer beside your bed with your earrings in, he doesn't, everything, his ears are wide open, he's totally conscious, meditative mindfulness. People would give their car away to have such a quality of mindfulness. But look at the intention. So when we're speaking about a mindful life and conscious life, about what we do, it also invites us to be aware of the intention that influences the mindfulness as a safeguard for oneself and others. It sounds simple, I know, but if you listen and find ways to apply this as the network of mind-body network and Simi's teaching in the school, such vital and important work, and others, it really has an extraordinary capacity in a rather quiet but significant way to really change our life, to really help us look at things differently, in which that relationship of intention and mindfulness. And the Buddha asks, what is worth being mindful of in life? What's worth really being mindful of? In the culture that we live in, I have the privilege of teaching the Dharma. Dharma means teachings and practices for a wise and liberated life. I have the privilege of teaching the Dharma last 25 years. It's taking me to most years, many years, in fact, four continents in the year, and privilege of as well of contact and meeting with many, many people. And I don't think as human beings, frankly, we are very well equipped or ready to live happily, healthily, and insightfully in the kind of society that we have. I just don't think men and women are equipped for it. And what I mean by that is, there are two things which seem to me to be going on. One is that there are huge demands upon us, and they can be from parents, from our educators, from our politicians, from the state, but also, of course, from the corporate world that uses the vehicle of advertising. And we internalize these day in and day out. Then there are also the internal demands that we make upon ourselves of how we should be. And the collision of external and internal makes for problems. It makes for tension. It makes for unhappiness. It makes for hardship. And therefore we need to look, what ways and what skillful ways in my life am I learning to handle the demands made upon me? What skillful ways am I working to learn to handle the demands which are made of me? When it comes to love, there is often in the emotional life a difficulty to be able to recognize what's love and what isn't. And these two get confused together. So our mindfulness or our awareness is trying to distinguish one from the other. If it's love, it's a kind of quiet force of care, concern, and support. And that would show itself to ourselves, it would show itself to others. A real concern which gives support for others and gets expressed by what we say, by what we feel, by what we do, and what we can offer and allow. And that is love. And it's a beautiful thing in life for you and I to touch those places of love, to find the skillful ways to work with others, both loved ones, friends, family and children, but all those, also those that we meet wherever it might be, and to find ways to express that. But sadly, the love easily gets corrupted by demands. That demand may be putting pressure on somebody in some way or other. That demand may be possessiveness. The demand may show itself as jealousy. One fears that the person that one loves, is their love is moving towards somebody else. That demand may be blaming the person for their faults, for their being unmindful. And then we have the conceit, actually it's the arrogance, which comes in and says, well, I'm like that with you because I love you. What a funny way to show love, by blaming, getting angry, getting resentful, finding fault. And we have the conceit to call this love. Actually, if we can just begin to distinguish between love, as a way I spoke of, and what corrupts it, and that we are honest with ourselves, when we're angry, when we're negative, we are like that because we are angry and we're negative. We're not like that because we're loving. And I think it's unfair on love to use love as a reason to make somebody's life miserable.
It's a contradiction. So mindfulness and awareness is recognizing clearly and admitting to ourselves what is what. I have two friends in Germany. Once a week, those some of you in good relationships, or not so good relationships, or not even sure if you're in a relationship, or whatever. I'm not only talking about male-female male-female. Different relationships are important. So in this case, it's a man and woman. They've been living together for 11 years. And little things build up. And perhaps one or two of you have this. You're working with somebody, you know somebody, but maybe at home, maybe at work. Little things build up. Nothing too dramatic. You don't feel like getting an army tank and blowing them away. Might do at times, but little tensions build up. And they were finding this in their relationship. And things were going unsaid. So the unsaid gets a little power to it, and it blocks the love. So they started a little institution at home together. Rather nice term. They called it deep time. And deep time is they sat down together, usually for about an hour or up to an hour and a half, and they talked about their communication with each other. They talked about what they appreciated, which had gone unsaid. They talked about what irritated them, or if you prefer the vernacular, what pissed them off with each other. They talked about if one was neglecting the other. There are a few men who have a deeper relationship with their computer than with their partners. I've been to America, I've seen there have been a few divorces. The guy's preferred his computer, and so he left the other. So anything can be a source of difficulty and tension in various ways. The deep time together and the talking together with appreciation and checking in with each other, and now our friends, parents are doing it with their children, just making this time together, gave a point of renewal. And just doing it once a week has made, so far, I don't say their marriage is going to last into eternity, but so far has made an extraordinary difference, because they began to realize it's not always, as so many of us think, quantity of time that matters. What's deep is the quality. It's quality. And I think we're all in need of real quality time with a human being that we know, or with human beings that we know that we can meet. And I feel if this love and connection was really taking place, we wouldn't have this terrible anxiety that's going on with men and women who would love to be in a relationship, a personal relationship, and it just doesn't happen. Who would love to have children, and it just doesn't happen. And I think it's more a yearning, and a very deep and human one, for closeness, for intimacy. And if we really nourished each other, and really listened, and really had quality time together, and really connected with each other, that would feed us and nourish us. And so it wouldn't matter so much whether I'm in a really personal romantic relationship with somebody. It wouldn't really matter if I have children, if I don't have children, because we can feel the depth of the quality through being together. Our society is not providing the resources for this. It's tragic. It's tragic. And we have to start feeling differently and looking differently. I'll give you a small example. At the retreat together, and you know, as I mentioned, you know, great number of great crowd of people, wonderful. We had two staffs of ten, staff of ten in each retreat, and the first one, and Odelia here was the manager and the team for the kitchen work, and other friends, Fat and many others are organizing. And at the end of the day, we sat together, and for about an hour, and sometimes it went a bit longer, and we just spoke about our day together, and what our experiences were during the day, how life went with the managers and with the cooks and with the teachers, etc. We just checked in with each other, and it built up, I felt, for me, and I hope for the others, they said it did, it built up a kind of friendship and a good contact and a good communication, and we listened to each other, and I think we all worked better. We had a lot of fun, and we enjoyed it, and we did service for other people, all on a voluntary basis. Now, why can't that happen in schools? Why can't that happen in the factory? Why can't that happen in the Knesset? It would certainly change the foreign policy quickly. Why can't it happen with people just meeting together, time together, in the workplace, for an hour, checking in with each other, enjoying the communication with each other? And what I notice in my life, and perhaps you do as well, that often, if we're putting out a lot of effort and say, oh, my job is so hard, I have to work so hard, I've got to study so hard, I've so much to do, I never get things done, it's like there's a lot of demands again, and a lot of pressure and effort. But I'm not sure if it's love. Sometimes it's an obligation. Sometimes it's a feeling I have to. But when men and women get together in our various roles and we share together, it touches deep places. We, as it were, we get the renewal on the job. Because we're enjoying it, happy. Now, how many people will say, who are working amongst you, Monday to Friday, oh, I wish I didn't have to go home. I wish I could be here and continue working all Saturday and all Sunday. But that's what the staff were saying when we came to the end of the retreat. Oh, Christopher, it's a pity it's finishing. We'd love to go on. Why can't you stay longer? Why can't Stephen Fulda, who I call the chief rabbi of the Dharma in Israel, why can't you stay longer? And people are working 6 in the morning till 10 at night for other people and saying, please, let's continue with this. So love and happiness and interaction and support makes our life. When is the business world going to wake up? Huh? When is the political world, the social world, when is the private sector, when is the public sector going to wake up and say, hey, love matters, love counts? It's asleep on its feet. It's tragic. No wonder people are so stressed. No wonder people are so tense. No wonder people keep having doubts, as they do in Britain. 80% of women in Britain asked in an opinion poll, what would you like to continue in this job or be out of it? And 80%, I'd rather be out of it. 1 in 3 men said, I regularly feel depressed at work. This is an indictment of a society which cannot deal with what we've created. Something has to start shifting, and love has an important place in it. It's tragic. Tragic what we're doing. In our looking into areas of love and exploring and finding ways together, nice various sentient beings travel around here. The Buddhists would say, oh, the cat's lending an ear on the teaching, is going to be obviously destined for a human rebirth. It's a joke. Dharma teachings are not concerned with future rebirths. Dharma teachings are concerned with the rebirth of egotism here and now, and to end the rebirth of the ego in the present moment. That's what we're concerned with, not speculating about as I said to our Tibetan friends, who is talking about the bardo. Have some of you heard of the bardo? You know about that? If bardo, you die and then you go through this transition called the bardo into the next birth. And I'd say, frankly, I find Brigitte Bardot far more interesting than they don't understand. So the expression of love and the expression of finding ways in our life to communicate it, and I do think it's important with that regard to really share and offer that. Let's take schools as an example of what I mean. I don't know how it is in Israel, but from parents and educators in the European Union, there's terrible pressure on young people. Young, I mean, from the time they go to school all the way through. And that pressure is basically to absorb as much information as possible and then to recycle it onto pieces of paper. It's the worst form of recycling imaginable, and we're calling this education. So we're just dealing with a little corner of the called the brain, pumping the information in, getting them to think about it, which they don't, because they much prefer, it's much quicker to go to the internet and just download the information. We go through it and then put it back out and then get examined on it with all the pressure that goes with it. When are we going to, and this is slowly beginning to register through various programs and projects, realize that we need to attend to the whole human being. Therefore, yes, the mind, meaning knowledge and information, is important, but also feelings and emotional life is important. Also, physical life is important. Connection is important. Mindfulness is important. Fresh kinds of spiritual awarenesses are important. And if you and I, with our children, those that we work with and work for, including our own, if we tend to look at, say, the whole person, the mind, the heart, the body, the communication, the expressions of love and warmth, and really give a really nourishing environment that looks and uses a wide range of helpful mindfulness meditation and methods of technique to give support, it can make an enormous difference to a person's life, because the person feels, all of me is being looked at. What our system does is creating a system of successes and failures, a system in which some are very good and succeed and some are at the bottom and don't succeed. To give you a small example, in my daughter's school, she now left school, there was one boy who was considered a dunce. You know the word dunce? I mean, doesn't know anything. Didn't like going to school, missed school, never passed any examinations, had low reading ability, low writing ability, etc. The view of him was, or the view that he gave himself, even though the teachers did their best, was feeling worthless, feeling not very good, everybody else was better than him. This boy, 15 years of age, was a genius with car engines. And with older students, 18, 19, and their parents, instead of paying a fortune to these mechanics, charging the earth per hour, 20 to 40 pound per hour in Britain, they go down and think, where's that 15 year old? Where's Tommy? Go and get Tommy. Tommy would come down, we'll give whatever you like, strip a car, you know, when I look under the bonnet, you know, I might as well be on the moon. I have no idea. I haven't actually got a car, so, but anyway, look under the bonnet, with no idea. And he could take a car, engine a car apart, put the whole thing back together, and people would be thrilled. Where does he know this at 15 from? He said, I just learnt by myself. My dad showed me a bit and I learnt by myself. But there was no recognition for him of this extraordinary talent he had and truly worthwhile thing in the school. So he still felt useless, worthless, because he wasn't getting real affirmation. Everybody has skill. Everybody has a lot of talent. Everybody can do wonderful things in this world. We've got to recognize with each other what that is and how it might be developed and cultivated. And I think those of you who are the privileged in the schools know that very, very well. And even for the Tommies of the world who are hopeless in the classroom, it's because perhaps somewhere else, something else can be responded to and touched upon there. And we've got to keep our eyes and ears open and find ways to do that. It's a challenge for us. But it would create a culture of an awakened life, a culture of love, and a culture of mindfulness. And it's up to people like ourselves, who are thoughtful and concerned, actually to come here, to, as we do this evening, say, what can I do to bring more love into this world? My goodness, doesn't every song have the word love in it? Eh? Doesn't every one of those miserable soap operas all about love? Isn't every dreadful movie that pours out of Hollywood all got love running in it, and then it all ends up happily ever after? If ever there was not living in the real world, it's Hollywood. Isn't love in the theatre, in the plays, in the poetry, in the literature? They're deep concerned with it. But we've got to find ways, as I say, inwardly and outwardly, which contribute to its expression. It's a challenge. Yesterday morning, let me just, I'll talk about Nablus with you. Yesterday morning, I left here to with Palestinian driver, yes. Israeli number plate, to travel to Srem, to Nablus. I was invited by the Socialist and Social Welfare Union in Nablus, and these are a group of men and women, or some in Nablus alone. There are some 500 people who are members of this organization, and part of their work is to contribute to relieving some of the great pain and distress that is taking place there, owing to the military occupation of their land. And after going through all the controls and the checkpoints and the town itself, I think about 120,000 people in Nablus, which is totally surrounded by the occupying army, and all the difficulties that go along with that. And if I may say, I'm not going to, I could sit here and in one 24 hour visit, 18 hours of non-stop talking and listening there, I could talk to you 2 hours about things I've seen by my own eyes, listened to with the groups of people, but I'll just keep it very short, short with you. The purpose of my day was to give a workshop for about 20 people on the transformation of suffering, and all the women and men, mostly in their 20s, I might say, who are working in the town and in the villages with all those who have directly suffering as a result of this terrible and tragic situation which is going on for them, where they're going into the villages, the towns, and sometimes taking many hours for families where their children have died, or their sons, brothers, mothers, and members of the family. And the figures that they gave me, which have been given out in the West as well, is that around 600 men, women, and children have died in the occupied territories, and around 20,000 injured. And that, what is it, about 30 to 1 figure is fairly normal. I've done peace activism work around the world, fairly normal kind of figure, and in the ratio. And in listening to them, and I made the day, if I may say, as practical as possible. And what I did with this one small exercise, which I did, I said to them, and I pulled the chair into the middle of the room, I said, I am a 12-year-old boy, and I have been involved in the Intifada, and please remember, no, I do not support one bullet nor one stone. I'm an activist for non-violence. And I said in the chair, I said, I'm a 12-year-old boy, and I've been beaten, I've had tear gas, and every time I hear a fighter plane fly over, every time I hear stories, I run to my bedroom and I pull the bed covers over my head because I'm so terrified. This was reported to me several times by the workers, field workers. And I said, so I'm frozen and I'm afraid and I've got nobody to turn to. And I said to the group, I want one of you to bring a chair up. What are you going to say to me? I'm the 12-year-old boy. What are you going to say to me? It was very, even in just role play, it was intense, I have to say. And then I said, I am a mother. And then people came forward and spoke to me heart to heart, eye to eye, person to person, women and men, and many of the women, men, of course, are from the Muslim culture, and with hair covered, and just speaking very closely what they say. And then I said, I am a mother. I've just been told that my son is dead. What are you going to say to me? What are you going to tell me? I feel incredibly depressed. I feel unhappy, I can't stop crying, I'm suicidal, I just don't know what to do, I can't attend to the other children, my husband, my friends, I don't want to go outdoors, I can't deal with this anymore. What are you going to say to me? This is going on every day in Nablus. This is going on every day in the area around, as it must go on here as well, I know. And so they came forward and we dialogued. Then afterwards I gave a commentary on what I heard, methods and suggestions and techniques for working with the situation. And of course, in come the night hours last night in Nablus, one can hear the bullets firing as the army, the military occupants on both sides of the hill looking down into the valley of Nablus. And now the situation is so bad that I ask people individually, activists very committed to the peace process, they say in this situation it is now far worse than the Intifada of the 1980s. Far, far worse. People of Israel have to wake up, have to think about this situation. If you put a cat and you put pressure on that cat in the corner of the room by pushing up a bar or a rod against it, that cat would become a tiger and scream and fight back. And that's what the occupying army is doing on these people. They have no right to be there. And please tell those of you who are adults here, if you have sons, please tell your sons to refuse to go there. Refuse to put their hand on the rifle and go into other people's territory and keep them prisoners. It's a nightmare, that situation for them. I listened to many voices yesterday in groups of people, not just individually, where people can exaggerate. So something in our way of looking, so that in some way or other, and I think this is the important thing, because somehow, if in some way we can express our concern and not to be charged with our fears, if some way we can express our concern, and a deep concern, I think there's some kind of moral authority that can come from us. And that moral authority, as the process was working well between the two communities. But I'm afraid this government,